listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
As we reported last week, Russia's President Vladimir Putin announced the development and implementation in some cases of a number of weapons systems which he said could defeat American anti-missile systems. State Department officials and others in the U.S. government said that Putin had declared a new arms race. However, Russia has been saying for more than a decade that U.S. actions on its borders were creating a climate of confrontation that would eventually have to be answered. In February of 2007, President Putin spoke in Munich on exactly that point, and what follows are his words in their entirety, delivered to the Munich Conference on Security.
Thank you very much, dear Madam Federal Chancellor, Mr. Telchik, ladies and gentlemen. Only 2 decades ago, the world was ideologically and economically divided, and it was the huge strategic potential of 2 superpowers that ensured global security. This global standoff pushed the sharpest economic and social problems to the margins of the international communities and the world's agenda. And just like any war, the Cold War left us with live ammunition, figuratively speaking. I'm referring to ideological stereotypes, double standards, and other typical aspects of Cold War bloc thinking. The unipolar world that had been proposed after the Cold War did not take place either. The history of humanity certainly has gone through unipolar periods. We've seen aspirations to world supremacy and what hasn't happened in world history. However, what is a unipolar world? However one might embellish this term, at the end of the day, it refers to one type of situation, namely one center of authority, one center of force, one center of decision-making. It is a world in which there is one master, one sovereign, and at the end of the day, this is promiscuous not only for those within this system, but also for the sovereign itself, because it destroys itself from within. And this certainly has nothing in common with democracy, because, as you know, democracy is the power of the majority, in light of the interests and opinions of the minority. Incidentally, Russia, we are constantly being taught about democracy, but for some reason those who teach us do not want to learn themselves. I consider that the unipolar model is not only unacceptable, but also impossible in today's world. And this is not only because if there was individual leadership in today's and precisely in today's world, and the military, political, and economic resources would not suffice. What is even more important is that the model itself is flawed, because at its basis, there is and can be no moral foundations for modern civilization. Along with this, what is happening in today's world, and we just started to discuss this, is a tentative to introduce precisely this concept into international affairs, the concept of a unipolar world, and with which results unilateral and frequently illegitimate actions have not resolved any problems. Moreover, they have caused new human tragedies and created new centers of tension. Judge for yourselves. Wars, as well as local and regional conflicts, have not diminished. Mr. Telchik mentioned this very gently. And no less people perish in these conflicts. Even more are dying than before. Significantly more. Significantly more. Today we are witnessing an almost uncontained hyper-use of force, military force, in international relations. Force that is plunging the world into an abyss of permanent conflicts. As a result, we do not have sufficient strength to find a comprehensive solution to any one of these conflicts. Finding a political settlement also becomes impossible. We are seeing a greater and greater disdain for the basic principles of international law, and independent legal norms are, as a matter of fact, coming increasingly closer to one state's legal system. One state, and of course, first and foremost, the United States, has overstepped its national borders in every way. This is visible in the economic, political, cultural, and educational policies it imposes on other nations. Well, who likes this? Who is happy about this? In international relations, we increasingly see the desire to resolve a given question according to so-called issues of political expediency based on the current political climate. And of course, this is extremely dangerous. It results in the fact that no one feels safe. I want to emphasize this. No one feels safe, because no one can feel that international law is like a stone wall that will protect them. Of course, such a policy stimulates an arms race. The force's dominance inevitably encourages a number of countries to acquire weapons of mass destruction. Moreover, significantly new threats, though they were also known before, have appeared, and today threats such as terrorism have taken on a global character. I am convinced that we have reached that decisive moment when we must seriously think about the architecture of global security. And we must proceed by searching for a reasonable balance between the interests of all participants in international dialogue, especially since the international landscape is so varied and changes so quickly. Changes in the light of the dynamic development in a whole number of countries and regions. Madam Federal Chancellor already mentioned this. The combined GDP, measured in purchasing power parity of countries such as India and China, is already greater than that of the United States, and a similar calculation with the GDP of the BRIC countries. Brazil, Russia, India, and China surpasses the cumulative GDP of the EU. And according to experts, this gap will only increase in the future. There is no reason to doubt that the economic potential of the new centers of global economic growth will inevitably be converted into political influence and will strengthen multipolarity. In connection with the role of multilateral diplomacy, is significantly increasing. The need for principles such as openness, transparency, and predictability in politics is uncontested, and the use of force should be a really exceptional measure, comparable to using the death penalty in the judicial systems of certain states. However, today we are witnessing the opposite tendency, namely a situation in which countries that forbid the death penalty, even for murderers and other dangerous criminals, are airily participating in military operations that are difficult to consider legitimate. And as a matter of fact, these conflicts are killing people, hundreds and thousands of civilians. But at the same time, the question arises of whether we should be indifferent and aloof to various internal conflicts inside countries, to authoritarian regimes, to tyrants, and to the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. As a matter of fact, this was also at the center of the question that our dear colleague Mr. Lieberman asked the Federal Chancellor. If I correctly understood your question, then of course it is a serious one. Can we be indifferent observers in view of what is happening? I will try to answer your question as well. Of course not. But we do have the means to counter these threats. Certainly we do. It is sufficient to look at recent history. Did not our country have a peaceful transition to democracy? Indeed, we witnessed a peaceful transformation of the Soviet regime. A peaceful transformation. And what a regime. With what a number of weapons, including nuclear weapons. Why should we start bombing and shooting now at every available opportunity? Is it the case when without the threat of mutual destruction, we do not have enough political culture, respect for democratic values and for the law? I am convinced that the only mechanism that can make decisions about using military force as a last resort is the Charter of the United Nations. And in connection with this, either I did not understand what our colleague, the Italian Defense Minister, just said, or what he said was inexact. In any case, I understood that the use of force can only be legitimate when the decision is taken by NATO, the EU, or the UN. If he really does think so, then we have different points of view. Or I didn't hear correctly. The use of force can only be considered legitimate if the decision is sanctioned by the UN. And we do not need to substitute NATO or the EU for the UN. When the UN will truly unite the forces of the international community and can really react to events in various countries, when we will leave behind this disdain for international law, then the situation will be able to change. Otherwise, the situation will simply result in a dead end, and the number of serious mistakes will be multiplied. Along with this, it is necessary to make sure that international law have a universal character both in the conception and application of its norms. And one must not forget that democratic political actions necessarily go along with discussion and are laborious decision-making processes. Dear ladies and gentlemen, the potential danger of the destabilization of international relations is connected with obvious stagnation in the disarmament issue. Russia supports the renewal of dialogue on this important question. It is important to conserve the international legal framework relating to weapons destruction and therefore ensure continuity in the process of producing nuclear weapons. Together with the United States of America, we agreed to reduce our nuclear strategic missile capabilities to up to 1,700 to 2,000 nuclear warheads by the 31st of December 2012. Russia intends to strictly fulfill the obligations it has taken on. We hope that our partners will also act in a transparent way and will refrain from laying aside a couple of hundred superfluous nuclear warheads for a rainy day. And if today the new American defense minister declares that the United States will not hide these superfluous weapons in warehouse or, as one might say, under a pillow or under the blanket, then I suggest that we all rise and greet this declaration standing. It would be a very important declaration. Russia strictly adheres to and intends to further adhere to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, as well as the multilateral supervision regime for missile technologies. The principles incorporated in these documents are universal ones. In connection with this, I would like to recall that in the 1980s, the USSR and the United States signed an agreement on destroying a whole range of small and medium-range missiles. But these documents do not have a universal character. Today, many other countries have these missiles, including the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the Republic of Korea, India, Iran, Pakistan, and Israel. Many countries are working on these systems and plan to incorporate them as part of their weapons arsenals. And only the United States and Russia bear the responsibility to not create such weapon systems. It is obvious that in these conditions, we must think about ensuring our own security. At the same time, it is impossible to sanction the appearance of new destabilizing high-tech weapons. Needless to say, it refers to measures to prevent a new area of confrontation, especially in outer space. Star Wars is no longer a fantasy, it is a reality. In the middle of the 1980s, our American partners were already able to intercept their own satellites. In Russia's opinion, the militarization of outer space could only have unpredictable consequences for the international community and provoke nothing less than the beginning of a nuclear era. And we have come forward more than once with initiatives designed to prevent the use of weapons in outer space. Today I would like to tell you that we have prepared a project for an agreement on the prevention of deploying weapons in outer space. And in the near future, it will be sent to our partners as an official proposal. Let's work on this together. Plans to expand certain elements of the anti-missile defense system to Europe cannot help but disturb us. Who needs the next step of what would be, in this case, an inevitable arms race? I deeply doubt that Europeans themselves do. Missile weapons with a range of about 5,000 to 8,000 kilometers that really pose a threat to Europe do not exist in any of the so-called problem countries. And in the near future and prospects, this will not happen and is not even foreseeable. And any hypothetical launch of, for example, a North Korean rocket to American territory through Western Europe obviously contradicts the laws of ballistics. As we say in Russia, it would be like using the right hand to reach the left ear. And in Germany, I cannot help but mention the pitiable condition of the Treaty on Conventional Armed Forces in Europe. The adapted Treaty on Conventional Armed Forces in Europe was signed in 1999. It took into account a new geopolitical reality, namely the elimination of the Warsaw Bloc. 7 years have passed, and only four states have ratified this document, including the Russian Federation. NATO countries openly declared that they will not ratify this treaty, including the provisions on flank restrictions, on deploying a certain number of armed forces in the flank zones, until Russia removed its military bases from Georgia and Moldova. Our army is leaving Georgia, even according to an accelerated schedule. We resolved the problems we had with our Georgian colleagues, as everybody knows. There are still 1,500 servicemen in Moldova that are carrying out peacekeeping operations and protecting warehouses with ammunition left over from Soviet times. We constantly discuss this issue with Mr. Solana, and he knows our position. We are ready to further work in this direction. But what is happening at the same time? Simultaneously, the so-called flexible frontline American bases, with up to 5,000 men in each. It turns out that NATO has put its frontline forces on our borders, and we continue to strictly fulfill the treaty obligations. And do not react to these actions at all. I think it is obvious that NATO expansion does not have any relation with the modernization of the alliance itself or with the ensuring security in Europe. On the contrary, it represents a serious provocation that reduces the level of mutual trust. And we have the right to ask, against whom is this expansion intended? And what happened to the assurances our Western partners made after the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact? Where are those declarations today? No one even remembers them, but I will allow myself to remind this audience what was said. I would like to quote the speech of NATO General Secretary, Mr. Warner, in Brussels on the 17th of May, 1990. He said at that time that the fact that we are ready not to place a NATO army outside of German territory gives the Soviet Union a firm security guarantee. Where are these guarantees? The stones and concrete blocks of the Berlin Wall have long been distributed as souvenirs, but we should not forget that the fall of the Berlin Wall was possible thanks to a historic change, one that was also made by our people, the people of Russia, a choice in favor of democracy, freedom, openness, and a sincere partnership with all the members of the big European family. And now they are trying to impose new dividing lines and walls on us. These walls may be virtual, but they are nevertheless dividing, ones that cut through our continent. And is it possible that we will once again require many years and decades, as well as several generations of politicians, to dissemble and dismantle these new walls? Dear ladies and gentlemen, we are unequivocally in favor of strengthening the regime of non-proliferation. The present international legal principles allow us to develop technologies to manufacture nuclear fuel for peaceful purposes. And many countries, with all good reasons, want to create their own nuclear energy as a basis for their energy independence. But we also understand that these technologies can be quickly transformed into nuclear weapons. This creates serious international tensions. The situation surrounding the Iranian nuclear program acts as a clear example, and if the international community does not find a reasonable solution for resolving these conflicts of interest, the world will continue to suffer similar destabilizing crises. Because there are more threshold countries than simply Iran. We both know this. We are going to constantly fight against the threat of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Last year, Russia put forward the initiative to establish international centers for the enrichment of uranium. We are open to the possibility that such centers not only be created in Russia, but also in other countries where there is a legitimate basis for using civil nuclear energy. Countries that want to develop their nuclear energy could guarantee that they will receive fuel through direct participation in these centers. And the centers would, of course, operate under strict IAEA supervision. The latest initiatives put forward by American President George W. Bush are in conformity with the Russian proposals. I consider that Russia and the USA are objectively and equally interested in strengthening the regime of the non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and their deployment. It is precisely our countries with leading nuclear and missile capabilities that must act as leaders in developing new, stricter non-proliferation measures. Russia is ready for such work. We are engaged in consultations with our American friends. In general, we should talk about establishing a world system of political incentives and economic stimuli, whereby it would not be in the state's interest to establish their own capabilities in the nuclear fuel cycle. but they would still have the opportunity to develop nuclear energy and strengthen their energy capabilities. In connection with this, I shall talk about international energy cooperation in more detail. Madam Federal Chancellor also spoke about this briefly. She mentioned, touched on this theme. In the energy sector, Russia intends to create uniform market principles and transparent conditions for all. It is obvious that energy prices must be determined by the market instead of being the subject of political speculation, economic pressure, or blackmail. We are open to cooperation. Foreign companies participate in all our major energy projects. According to different estimates, up to 26% of the oil extraction in Russia, and please think about this figure, up to 26% of the oil extraction in Russia is done by foreign capital. Try to find me a similar example where Russian businesses participate extensively in the key economic sectors in Western countries. Such examples do not exist. There are no such examples. I would also recall the parity of foreign investments in Russia and those Russia makes abroad. The parity is about 15 to 1. And here you have an obvious example of the openness and stability of the Russian economy. Economic security is the sector in which all must adhere to uniform principles. We are ready to compete fairly. For that reason, more and more opportunities are appearing in the Russian economy. Experts and our Western partners are objectively evaluating these changes. As such, Russia's OECD sovereign credit rating improved, and Russia passed from the fourth to the third group. And today in Munich, I would like to use this occasion to thank our German colleagues for their help in the above decision. Furthermore, as you know, the process of Russia joining the WTO has reached its final stages. I would point out that during long, difficult talks, we heard words about freedom of speech, free trade, and equal possibilities more than once, but for some reason, exclusively in reference to the Russian market. And there is still one more important theme that directly affects global security. Today, many talk about the struggle against poverty. What is actually happening in this sphere? On the one hand, financial resources are allocated for programs to help the world's poorest countries, and at times substantial financial resources. But to be honest, and many here also know this, linked with the development of that same donor country's companies. And on the other hand, developed countries simultaneously keep their agricultural subsidies and limit some countries' access to high-tech products. And let's say things as they are. One hand distributes charitable help, and the other hand not only preserves economic backwardness, but also reaps the profits thereof. The increasing social tension in depressed regions inevitably results in the growth of radicalism, extremism, feeds terrorism and local conflicts. And if all this happens in, shall we say, a region such as the Middle East, where there is increasingly the sense that the world at large is unfair, then there is the risk of global destabilization. It is obvious that the world's leading countries should see this threat, and that they should therefore build a more democratic, fairer system of global economic relations, a system that would give everyone the chance and the possibility to develop. Dear ladies and gentlemen, speaking at the conference on security policy, it is impossible not to mention the activities of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE. As is well known, this organization was created to examine all, I shall emphasize this, all aspects of security, military, political, economic, humanitarian, and especially the relations between these spheres. What do we see happening today? We see that this balance is clearly destroyed. People are trying to transform the OSCE into a vulgar instrument designed to promote the foreign policy interests of one or of a group of countries. And this task is also being accomplished by the OSCE's bureaucratic apparatus, which is absolutely not connected with the state founders in any way, decision-making procedures, and the involvement of so-called non-governmental organizations are tailored for this task. These organizations are formally independent, but they are purposefully financed and therefore under control. According to the founding documents, in the humanitarian sphere, the OSCE is designed to assist country members in observing international human rights norms at their request. This is an important task. We support this. But this does not mean interfering in the internal affairs of other countries, and especially not imposing a regime that determines how these states should live and develop. It is obvious that such interference does not promote the development of democratic states at all. On the contrary, it makes them dependent and, as a consequence, politically and economically unstable. We expect that the OSCE be guided by its primary task and build relations with sovereign states based on respect, trust, and transparency. Dear ladies and gentlemen, in conclusion, I would like to note the following. We very often, and personally, I very often, hear appeals by our partners, including our European partners, to the effect that Russia should play an increasingly active role in world affairs. In connection with this, I would allow myself to make one small remark. It is hardly necessary to incite us to do so. Russia is a country with a history that spans more than 1,000 years and has practically always used the privilege to carry out an independent foreign policy. We are not going to change this tradition today. At the same time, we are well aware of how the world has changed. We have a realistic sense of our own opportunities and potential. And of course, we would like to interact with responsible and independent partners, with whom we could work together in constructing a fair and democratic world order that would ensure security and prosperity, not only for a select few, but for all. Thank you for your attention.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Well, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The Syrian civil war is again escalating after taking only a short breath to celebrate the fall of ISIS. With neighboring powers getting deeper and deeper involved in the quagmire, what is next for the war-torn country? Well, I ask Robert Malley, former White House advisor on ISIS and the Middle East, and now head of the International Crisis Group.
As the Islamic State is reduced to a few pockets needing only to be mopped up, the other fronts in the Syrian war are seeing their embers rise into flames again. With clashes breaking out right across Syria, peace is once more a distant hope. But can the latest battles lead to game-changing results? How can peace conferences influence the situation? And will world powers have enough patience to hammer out a common solution?
Robert Malley, the Obama administration's advisor on ISIS and the Middle East, now head of the International Crisis Group. Welcome to the show. Good to have you with us, Mr. Malley.
Thank
the
you.
U.S. State Department is blaming Russia for the failed ceasefire in eastern Ghouta, saying that Russia has the influence to stop Damascus from attacking. And that's true. And Russia is using that influence to establish daily ceasefires and humanitarian corridors. But who has the influence over the rebels in eastern Ghouta? Who will tell them to stop firing rockets into Damascus? Could possibly State Department apply pressure to that side as well?
So, I mean, I worked, as you said, on the Syria file for a long time, including with many Russian colleagues over the years. And there's not a situation where you can't point to many parties that are responsible. But it is, I think it's a fact that in the case of Eastern Ghouta, it's the regime that has preponderant firepower, that has used that firepower in ways that I think are hard to describe sometimes, but certainly have been visible for people who've watched them, and that Russia has some influence. I wouldn't say they have total influence, but some influence in getting the Syrian government to respect the UN Security Council resolution. So I think that is something that Russia can and should do. There are other parties that have influence over the rebel groups. Turkey is one of them. The U.S. may have some. I mean, it depends. In each case, the groups are different. And the popular opinion will have some, in Eastern Ghouta, will have some impact if it saw that the bombing from the regime were to stop. It would also put pressure on the rebels to stop. But this is not, in none of these cases would I say that there's a single culprit, but in the case of Eastern Ghouta, I think there's no doubt that the principal, by far the principal aggressor, has been the government, and I think that's been widely recognized, and that should stop.
I think, like, well, if we follow the general logic, the regime, whether it's good regime or a bad regime, is fighting a war. So it can't just, like, sit there and do nothing, right? When there's, what, like, they're being fired at as well. So when the fight in Eastern Ghouta is discussed, like you said, it's usually about civilians and Assad's troops. But Assad's troops are really only there because the rebels are. So instead of, or at the same time as telling Assad's forces to stop their offensive, which I agree, they should, why not also tell the rebels to give up and, like, take buses to Idlib, like it happened in Aleppo or Homs? Why is this plan not discussed?
The Security Council resolution is, well, the Security Council resolution is clear, right? And Russia was one of the parties that agreed to it, which is that there needs to be a ceasefire. Now, after that, can there be modalities that are going to be negotiated in conformity with international law? Sure, but let's stop the firing on all sides, and certainly the International Crisis Group is calling for all sides to stop the firing. But, you know, there is, as I say, and I think it's clear for people who are watching it, there's one party that has preponderant use of force. Nobody's asking it not to exercise self-defense, but it isn't. This is not a case of self-defense. This is a case from reports that we see where there is often offensive action being taken against civilians in Eastern Ghouta. So, yes, the rebels are going to have to be, they're going to have to stop what they're doing. There's going to have to be an answer to the problems that are represented by the rebels, some of whom are engaged in activities that you just described as well. But the mandate of the, or the lesson of the Security Council resolution was very clear. It called for a ceasefire. So let's end the fire, to allow humanitarian access. People who want to leave could leave. People who don't want to leave don't have to leave. I'm talking about civilians now. And there's going to have to be a solution to the question of the rebels as well. But let's not mix things. There's a Security Council resolution, which Russia agreed to, which other members of the Security Council agreed to. Let's implement it. I think that's the first step.
So you said Russia has some influence on Assad's forces, not a lot, but some. What leverage does the United States have in a situation?
I did not say not a lot. I said not total influence.
Okay, not total influence.
I said not total influence. Yeah,
I just want to see what influence the other side has. What leverage does the U.S. have in a situation on the ground in Western Syria? How exactly can it influence the situation, in your opinion?
You know, frankly, I'm not sure today the U.S. has preponderant influence over the rebel groups. Others do. I mean, Turkey, in some sense, situations, has far more influence over the rebel groups than the U.S. has, or even that the U.S. used to have. And the U.S. today has less influence over the rebel groups because it gives less support to the rebel groups. So, by definition, it is going to have less leverage. I think this is a case where all the parties that have provided support, or that have provided, whether it's material support or moral support to the rebels, need to tell them they need to stop shelling regime-controlled areas as well. That has to stop, because it gives a justification, a pretext often, for the regime then to go in, and to go in with disproportionate force. I think, you know, again, if you just look at the pictures and hear the accounts, it's hard to call this simply a matter of self-defense. It's hard to call this consistent with international humanitarian law. So I think those shouldn't really be, those are not matters for debate. Yes, the rebels have to stop firing. The regime has to stop firing. There needs to be a ceasefire, and then some solution needs to be found. And Russia today has a role, a stronger role, probably than virtually anyone else in this theater, to try to make that happen. And they should use that influence to stop the shelling of civilians, certainly on both sides, but it has real influence on what it can get the regime to do.
So yeah, like in your organization's recent article, Russia is called a reluctant driver in a Syrian war and urged to take a more proactive role in a conflict, what you're saying right now. But Syria's battlefield is becoming largely internationalized. Russia may have good relations with Israel, Iran, Turkey, but do you really believe Moscow can just like tell all these countries, all these regional powers what to do?
No, And again, having served in the U.S. government, even the U.S. government can't tell its partners what to do. I think there's often a myth about how strong powers can sort of snap their fingers and lesser powers will obey. They won't, because they obey to their own logics and their own sense of self-interest. But our sense, and this was the report that we issued not long ago, which was not about East Ghouta, was really about southwest Syria, where we've seen this confrontation between Israel and against Iran and its allies in southwest Syria and beyond. In that situation, Russia does have real influence because it controls, to a large extent, the skies over Syria. And so Israel would have a hard time flying over Syria if Russia didn't want it to do so. And it also has, it does have influence and leverage over, and again, not total leverage, but some influence over the regime, over Iran, over Hezbollah. Certainly they will listen to what Russia has to say, even though they may not always follow what it has to say. But today there is no actor in Syria, and this is, you know, something I think Russia wanted to achieve. There's no actor in Syria that has as many and strong contacts with all players, all belligerents. You mentioned them: Israel, Hezbollah, the regime, the Syrian regime, Iran, Turkey. All of them do talk to Moscow. All of them want to talk to Moscow. All of them have an interest in preserving good relations with Moscow. That's not the case with the United States today. The United States has obviously strong relations with Israel. It has ambivalent relations with Turkey. It has no relation or bad relations with Iran, Hezbollah, and the regime. So when we say they're in the driver's seat, what we mean is they do have this sort of pivot place, this pivot role, and it should be in their interest to prevent things from getting out of hand, as they almost did a few weeks ago between Israel and Iran. President Putin appears to have stepped in and told people to calm down, but it might be better, certainly for Syria, we would argue it'd be better also for Russia's interest and for others, to step in sooner to try to make sure that a miscalculation or misunderstandings don't blow up, probably not even intentionally, but just blow up between the belligerents over whom, as we say, if not, Russia has some influence and some leverage.
So the International Crisis Group previously called for outright U.S. intervention in the Syrian civil war. Do you still feel
Never.
That at this
no.
point? Really?
No. I don't think the Crisis Group has ever called for U.S. intervention in the civil
but
war.
But you did call
certainly
to be
not
involved.
When I worked there. There was a period of time. Well, you'd have to be specific about being involved in
okay,
order to try
okay,
to broker
let
a solution
me rephrase
is
the
one
question.
Thing.
Okay,
being
Rob,
involved
let me
in
rephrase
terms
the
of
question.
Trying to,
do you feel
please.
Like America should be more involved
please.
Than it already is at this point in the Syrian conflict?
Not in the Syrian conflict. I think the U.S. should play a role, as others, to try to end the conflict. That's not trying to pour fuel on the fire, but to try to end the conflict. I've said, in the past, I think part of the mistake, I've said this publicly, about the policies that I was involved in, is that there was an inability to separate the humanitarian goal, which is to lessen, if not end, the suffering of the Syrian people, from the political goal, which was to get rid of Assad. And I think that goal should have been put aside, and the focus should have been on what do we need to do to end the suffering of the Syrian people. That should have been the priority from early on. And, that was not the case. So today, our organization's argument, our mandate, is not about regime change. It's not about, getting rid of Assad. It's about how do we end the violence among all sides. And that's why we do call on Russia, which has a role to play, which has influence to bear, to play that role. The U.S. also should not be, what we've made clear is that the U.S. should not use Syria as a battlefield against Iran, or whether it's a battlefield to try to stop Iran or to block Iran. That should not be the goal. The goal today, and I've believed this for some time, from early on, should be to end the violence, end the conflict, and let's put the political issues to the side for now. But, you have hundreds of thousands of Syrians who died as a result of this conflict. They should be the ones who we're thinking of.
Okay, Rob, we're going to take a short break right now. And when we're back, we'll continue talking to Robert Malley, Obama administration's advisor on the Middle East and president of the International Crisis Group, about the situation in Syria. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Robert Malley, the Obama administration's advisor on ISIS and the Middle East, now head of the International Crisis Group, talking about the war in Syria that is growing more and more complex. Mr. Malley, you met President Assad in person. Do you think he will stop short of conquering the whole territory from the rebels? I mean, would recovering its unity under Assad be ultimately better for Syria than splintering it into a patchwork of rebel warlord-controlled areas?
So I met him many years ago before the war, so I can't really claim that I know from those meetings how he will act. I think we know from the way he's been conducting the war that the goal is to reconquer or to retake as much of Syria as possible, and perhaps all of Syria. I don't think that that's something that's going to happen in the near term because of Turkey's presence and because of the U.S. Kurdish presence in the east. So I don't think that that's going to be an attainable goal. It is a goal that in the medium to long term the regime is going to continue pursuing. You know, it is going to raise an issue. I mean, again, one could say that one could take a position one way or the other about whether Assad should go. But it is clear that there are many constituencies in Syria who would not be thrilled to see the regime extend its writ back on that part of the country. Whether there are solutions, and I know that this is part of what different countries are talking about, whether there are solutions that would involve greater decentralization in Syria so that some of the areas that have been not under control of the regime for some time could be slightly more autonomous, even though they fall under the sovereignty of the state. That's something that needs to be discussed in the context of the political talks that are ongoing, whether in Geneva or as took place in Sochi in the context of talking about a new constitution. So theoretically, should the country be reunited and not be a patchwork and not have influence by different countries? Of course, and I'm sure that's what most Syrians would want. I don't think that that's realistic under current conditions. It may not be realistic as long as the regime is what it is today. I don't know. That's obviously something that the Syrians are going to have to decide. But there's, unfortunately, a lot of blood that's been spilt, and I'm sure that there's still, it's going to take some time for many Syrians to reconcile themselves to a different reality.
Now, the Geneva, the Sochi, Astana talks brought about achievements such as the confliction zone, observation posts, reconciliation centers, but obviously failed to dent the greater war itself. Can post-war Syria be decided during these conferences? I mean, is that realistic?
You know, having spent a long time in Geneva, both with the Russian colleagues, but also with the UN and others, it's hard to be particularly hopeful that what's going to be decided in Geneva is going to make as much of a difference as one might have hoped. The reality on the ground is what's going to determine the future of Syria, and that means the balance of power between among the warring parties, the warring Syrian parties, and there the regime certainly appears to have the upper hand. In most of Syria, I think, as I said, the exception is largely the Kurdish areas and Idlib. But then there's also the competition, as you say, among foreign powers, Turkey, Iran, Israel, etc. And Their views are also going to weigh heavily as to the future of Syria. So my own and crisis group's own assessment is that at this point we are looking at a patchwork that's not by any means ideal, and hopefully that can move towards a more decentralized Syria in which foreign parties exit. But that's, again, I think it depends on what time horizon you're talking about. I think for now the aspiration should be, the priority should be, lessen if not end the violence. And if that means having zones that are slightly different in terms of the way they're governed, in terms of the kind of influence that the regime exerts there, if that's a price to pay, that's an acceptable price to pay in order to stop the suffering, the bombing of hospitals, the bombing of civilians, the displacement, the refugee. If that, what we need to do is put a priority on that. And that may mean for some time that Syria will not be as unified as the regime or others may like it to be.
So the deconfliction agreements don't include jihadist brigades fighting in Idlib or elsewhere. And since they control a whole lot of territory, yeah. I mean, Assad soldiers will and have the right to move into Idlib and fight them. And that's probably what they're going to do if it comes down to it. So is deconfliction, therefore, just a symbolic move, seeing how it doesn't really concern the main front of the war?
So, I mean, this has been one of the issues that since 2015 we've been debating with Russia and others when I was in the administration, and now Crisis Group is grappling with, which is, of course, you know, we can't treat jihadists the same way as you treat civilians, and they are parties that are going to have to either change their behavior or they're going to have to be fought. But all too often it's been used as a pretext, a justification to go in and bomb everyone, including if they're not jihadists. And again, you know, there may be disagreement on this, but that's certainly been the experience that I saw, the experience of our folks on the ground, that the fig leaf or the pretext of saying we're going after jihadists, we're going after Nusra, we're going after Al-Qaeda, is often used to indiscriminately bomb people who have nothing to do with them. Now, the answer to that is, A, not to indiscriminately bomb, of course, but it's also to find ways to pressure those groups, either so that they disband or that they change. I mean, this has been one of the issues that has plagued Syria. And again, I think responsibility is not only on the regime and its allies. Many of the supporters of the opposition turned a blind eye when some of the less jihadist groups were get intermingled with the jihadist groups, and that became a real issue. And that's partly why we are in the situation we're in today. But if again, if one takes the position that the goal, the priority today, must be to lessen, if not end, the violence, then we need to take some time where we're going to stop the bombing and try to resolve the question of what to do with jihadist groups, and to do it in a way that actually is not going to affect and kill civilians. Because I think you know this, and your audience know this, under international law, it's not an excuse to say the reason we bombed civilians is because we were going after terrorists. Sometimes the United States has done the same thing, not on the scale that Russia is doing in Syria, I would argue, but sometimes other countries have gone in and on the claim that they were going after terrorist groups, they've often hit civilians. What seems to be happening in Syria is that that's being done in a more deliberate way, on a more large-scale way, and that's really what needs to stop.
All right, so this whole Assad must stay, Assad must go issue has been a debate forever. And Washington was first very adamant about Assad must go. Now we hear, well, wait, okay, Assad, you can maybe stay. Do you feel that State Department has a clear-cut line when it comes to Syria? I mean, does it really know what it's doing?
Listen, I think what happened is we went, as you say, from a period of Assad must go. Then during the first months of the Trump administration, it sounded as if that position had softened. If you go back and look at some of the statements that Secretary of State Tillerson or UN Ambassador Nikki Haley made, one thought that maybe there was a shift. Of late, very clearly, certainly in the words of Secretary Tillerson, we're back to Assad must go. As I said earlier, I think the priority now should not be Assad stays, Assad goes. We all could have our views and whether he's the right person to lead Syria at this time. But the priority for International Crisis Group is not, let's not focus on that now. Let's focus on ending the war, and let's not intermingle the humanitarian concern, which is the bombing of hospitals, the bombing of civilians, the shelling of Damascus by rebel groups. Let's not, and obviously the bombing by the regime, as I was mentioning earlier, let's not mix that with the political objectives, which some people may still have. We need to put those aside, the political objectives. Those need to be resolved at the negotiating table. They're not going to be resolved on the battlefield at this point. So I think that's the, I think the position of the State Department today, and of the, I assume of the White House, is clearer than it had been in the first months of the Trump administration. They're back to the notion that Assad needs to go, that the Geneva process needs to leave to his departure. And again, I negotiated this with some of many Russians and many others. We would spend years arguing over whether Assad should leave in a month or in 2 months or in 6 months, and years have gone by. So let's not waste more time on that question.
Yeah, I mean, really, I agree. We shouldn't be wasting more time on it. But like you've said, it does feel like, you know, the State DAP is back onto the Assad Moscow thing, you know. And I mean, isn't it a little strange? I mean, you seem like a sensible man, like you're not really picking sides. Isn't it a little strange the fact that there is a country or several countries which openly demand change in other governments by force? Why is that okay? I mean, if Venezuela just said, you know, sorry, we've had enough of you, Trump, you must go, and then, you know, start arming anti-Trump extremists, how would that look like to America?
You know, if I had to do the list of who's responsible, I think we wouldn't have enough time in an hour, but certainly the regime's disproportionate response, the decision by several outsiders to, as I say, mix the objective, which is to end the violence, with the political objective, which was to get rid of Assad. The fact that Syria became a battleground for regional influence between Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, etc., U.S., then Russia, all of that, and the fact that people were, in a way, encouraging the rebels to believe that they could topple the regime, which only further fueled the conflict. I think, you know, we'll have time in the months and years to come to look back and learn everything that shouldn't have been done in Syria. And as I say, I think everyone is going to come out of this looking pretty bad. The regime may look worse by some measure, but everyone else will look bad as well. But I think there'll be time to debate that, to debate a bigger question about humanitarian intervention. When is it justified? When is it not justified? That's a debate that has been taking place now for some decades. But let's not be paralyzed by that debate, and let's focus on what really matters today, and which is let's just silence the guns. So, well, you know, there's a question. Everyone will have their opinion. Was it right to call for Mubarak, for Gaddafi, for Saddam Hussein, for Assad to leave? What has it meant for the Middle East? Was that the right approach? I think Crisis Group has written in the past many times about the big flaws of U.S. policy that has tried to impose its will on other countries, and often in ways that have hurt not just the countries, but the U.S. as well, as we've seen certainly in Iraq. We could have that debate. It's a worthy debate to have, because there's also the debate, what does one do if one sees massacres in countries, whether it's in Rwanda or in Syria, where hundreds of thousands of people are killed? Does the international community, whatever that means, does it have a responsibility to step in and to stop that? I think that's a real question that people have to face, to which we don't have a good answer today. But all of those questions will have plenty of time to resolve. They need to be resolved. But let's not use it as a reason not to address the immediate urgent question of how to stop the killing in Syria.
All right, Mr. Malley, thanks a lot for this interview. We were talking to Robert Malley, former advisor to President Obama, now president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, discussing crisis in Syria. That's it for this edition of Sophie and Co. I'll see you next time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.